Good Friday evening. This is Ozarks at Large for August 7th, 2020 on your public radio station, 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead tonight, the U.S. Census is ending earlier than previously announced. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda will tell us more. And in just a few minutes, Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics reviews some of the week's news. Arkansas's cumulative number of COVID-19 cases jumps up by more than 1,000 today. Governor Asa Hutchinson announced 1,011 positive test results in the most recent 24-hour monitoring period. There are six additional deaths to report, and hospitalizations have increased by nine to reach a near-pandemic high of 523. 14 counties are reporting at least 20 new cases, led by Pulaski County with 182. 100 of those cases, the governor says, are a result of increased testing at the correctional facility in Wrightsville. In this region, Sebastian County reports 43 new cases, Washington County 41, Benton County 32. The governor says the increases in numbers come with an increase in tests administered compared to the past several days, slightly more than 6,200 test results received in the past 24 hours. Much of the briefing today devoted to a pair of fall events, the start of school and elections. The governor says he supports a proposal to set aside $20 million of CARE funds to provide support, if necessary, for school teachers and staff who may need to quarantine during the school year.
Which would cover for up to 2 weeks of paid leave. And it could be used by school employees who have to quarantine for COVID-related reasons. And so we know that there's going to be a positive case in the school. We know that because of that, we might have to have a staff person that has to quarantine or a teacher that has to quarantine. Even though they're not positive, they still need to do that. And so we don't want that to come out of their ordinary leave or their pocket.
The proposal will need approval from the CARES Act Steering Group. Arkansas Secretary of Education Johnny Key says a COVID-19 emergency leave policy would allow school employees to access that leave before having to resort to personal sick days. He says the $20 million in the proposal is an estimate for how much may be required for quarantining employees.
We tried to estimate high because we certainly do not know the level of outbreaks that we could have, but we want to be prepared when and if it does happen.
Secretary Key says the proposal, if approved, would apply to staff like bus drivers and cafeteria workers, as well as teachers. He also says the recent guidance issued by the Department of Education regarding five-day-a-week in-person classroom opportunities has been misunderstood by some. He says he has heard that some people have interpreted that guidance as meaning every student in every school district has to have in-person learning every day of the week.
And that's not at all the expectation. The expectation is that the campuses are open for those students and those families who do need that instruction, who need those therapies, or who need that intensive support that is only available to them on campus. For instance, a district that wants to have some alternative scheduling for some students, they could still offer that for those students for whom that works, but they need to have the campus open for the other students that need that five-day-a-week opportunity.
Governor Hutchinson says as of now, fall sports, including football, remain on schedule, and teams can begin practices with contact next week. The governor is also signing an executive order following up on Arkansas's Secretary of State John Thurston's ruling about absentee ballots.
Clearly defining that if you have a COVID-related concern about going to the polls in November, then you will qualify for an absentee ballot. And what we've seen since that announcement and clarification that our absentee ballot requests have increased rather dramatically.
The executive order also allows the 75 county clerks in the state to prepare absentee ballots for counting in advance earlier than usual. This fall, clerks can prepare absentee ballots for counting a week before Election Day. That's without opening the envelopes, so that on Election Day, the ballots will be counted in a quicker fashion. That actual counting, though, still cannot begin until 8:30 a.m. Election Day. There are more than 7,100 active cases of COVID-19 in Arkansas today, including more than 6,400 community cases. You can keep up to date with how COVID-19 is affecting our region and our state at KUAF.com and each weekday morning at 5:30 and 7:30 with Antoinette Grajeda's newscasts. me on the phone from his home office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. And I know, Michael, that you must have loved the temperatures for the first few days of August when we were seeing lows in the 50s and at midday it was lower 80s. You had to like that.
Yeah, but Kyle, this is 2020. It's going to, we'll hit, there'll be like 120 degree heat wave. Never in the history of Arkansas kind of heat wave will we hit. I mean,
that's true.
Anything's possible in this crazy.
All right, let's talk about the 188th. A 188th officer says Fort Smith is better positioned than other air bases for a pilot training center. Why is that?
Well, and he laid out some good reasons. Colonel Jeremiah Gentry, he's the vice commander of the 188th, and the 188th commander, Colonel Dodrow, has put Gentry in charge, being the point man for this process. Now, this all started back when the Secretary of Air Force, Barbara Barrett, essentially set up a process where they were going to create a single site for pilots to be trained on F-35 fighters, F-16s, and for the F-16 base for the Republic of Singapore to be co-located with it. Right now that base is at Luke Air Force Base. They've narrowed it down to five sites around the country. Fort Smith is one of them. Now, a little shout out to Captain Hollums, PR guy for 188. He hooked me up with Colonel Gentry. Colonel Gentry says that, first, there's always been strong community support in Fort Smith for jet missions. He said the ramp space at the 188 is twice what is needed. The area has 320 suitable weather days for flying. It's better than the required 240. And he says, and two other critical things, there is no other manned flying mission on the airbase as opposed to other missions. So they wouldn't be competing with other manned missions for airspace time. They'd be the only, as Gentry said, the pilot training center, quote, would be the primary customer. And so they wouldn't run the risk of having limited training time or being deprioritized and have to move again. But the biggest selling point, according to Gentry, is the Razorback Range. Now, that is a large airspace, one of the largest in Middle America. And it's just, it's part of the Fort Chaffee Maneuver Training Center. It's just 15 minutes east of the airfield. It's about, and Gentry, who's a F-16 pilot and an A-10 pilot, told me, he said, you literally, when you take off out of the Fort Smith Airport, you can barely get your landing gear up before you're on the range and ready to begin training. And so that saves fuel, has wear and tear on the aircraft, and get in more training time because the range is so close. He says none of the other four competitors have that advantage. You know, Kyle and I know that at those other four bases, they have their own Colonel Gentry. They have their own congressional delegation that's lobbying, and they're going to make say that they're better positioned. The first part of the decision will be made later this year, or the first part of 2021, with the final mission later, maybe at the end of 2021 or the first part of 2022. So there's still some time for this to play out.
The Future School has a pretty bright present. The school in Fort Smith received another grant, this one from the Wingate Foundation. What will this mean for the school?
Well, it's $1.25 million. I mean, it's a good chunk of change. And what it means is it moves them further along, gives them a lot of breathing room on this $5.5 million renovation that they're going to break ground on August 13th. It's going to add about 18,000, or about, I think it is exactly 18,000 square feet, and allows them to bring in a ninth grade when it's finished. And they've already received a $1 million donation from Dwight Curry, Fort Smith businessman, $650 million Walton Family Foundation grant. They've had some other funding come in, and they're already a 10th, 11th, and 12th grade school. So they're going to add this ninth grade class. And remember, this school opened its doors in downtown Fort Smith in August 2016. That was the first year. You know, sometimes us reporters get labeled as being, you know, we just like the negative stories, or, you know, the classic, if it bleeds, it leads kind of thing. But I like these little scrappy, small guy wins kind of stories. And to me, that's what Future School is, a little charter school that had to push its way through the objections of the Fort Smith Public School Board and had to make its case to the Arkansas Department of Education, two things which were not easy. Then it had to prove itself to the community, prove itself to students. Its student population is growing. Now, obviously, it's proving itself to the, you know, the outside world by getting these kind of grants. So I don't know. There's some objections out there to charter schools. I get that. But this is one of those little scrappy institution is making a go of it in a hell of a way. So I kind of like these stories.
Well, let me tell you what I did last night, Michael. I went to a local watering hole. I ordered a locally produced beer. I got it in a special cup. I got a wristband on my hand, and I walked around downtown Fayetteville with that locally brewed beer. It's the Entertainment District, the Aura, as it's called in Fayetteville. Other towns have done it. Now there could be one, will be one, a temporary one at Fort or at Chaffee Crossing. Where are we with this?
Yes, well, it was temporary, but the Fort Smith Board of Directors voted Tuesday to give it a permanent designation. So it's, I'm not going to try to explain the district, but it's around the hub at Chaffee Crossing. There'll be a restaurant there, living area, retail. It's kind of a mixed, or it's not kind of, it is a mixed use area. It's just, it's at the one of the entrances to ArcBest's new corporate headquarters, and it's near several new residential subdivisions. So it's an interesting place for this permanent designation. ERC Holdings was the one that pushed for it and got the temporary in, and then finally the board has approved this. But I think there, it's just the pressure of seeing, you know, Springdale's considering it, Fort right. Smith, or Fayetteville has it. I know downtown Fort Smith is looking at it.
You know, the first town to do it was that legendarily progressive town, Mountain Home, Arkansas.
You know, at least something good comes out of Mountain Home. you'll have to fill people in. Anyway.
Yeah. That's, folks, yeah, that's where I graduated from high school. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, that's Kyle's hometown. So this is going to be an interesting venue. We'll see. There were, as it seems there always are, there were some detractors. You know, gosh, this would just be an area where just a bunch of drunks are running around. It's going to be a bad example. And gosh, don't let the kids see all these drunks running around. But I think your experience in Fayetteville from other experiences that have been coming out of these districts is that it's anything but that, that it's just adults being able to move about in a confined area. I mean, it's not a large, we're not talking about hundreds of acres. Or,
right. A couple of things. You know, one idea is that it can help venues, if people are still very hesitant to go inside during the pandemic, you can it can help the bottom line for those businesses. Second, if any of these do turn into a stumbling ground of drunks, you can repeal it.
Oh yeah, and there are provisions. I'm not going to pretend to know the provisions in this, but I know that some have provisions to keep that from happening. And I think even some of the bars in Fayetteville have some responsibility. Yeah. In that respect as well. But this is going to become normal in 2 or 3 years.
I think
will there be a couple of idiots that abuse it? Sure. But I think overwhelmingly it's going to be popular.
There are always a couple of idiots. Let's just face it. But we are not those couple of idiots. Let's do this again next Friday. What do you say?
If you're willing, I'm willing.
All right. Michael Tilley's with Talk Business Politics. You can read all about all of these stories and more at talkbusiness.net. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome, sir.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. In collaboration with the Arkansas Department of Health, the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement, which works to improve health care outcomes for all Arkansans, is providing key local data to communities to help stop the spread of COVID-19. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
When the first presumptive case of COVID-19 was declared in Arkansas on March 11th, the Arkansas Department of Health published scant web data on the outbreak. The agency's COVID-19 web portal continues to improve daily, providing positive cases by county, demographics, testing, and death data. Finally, late last month, ADH started to publish new daily case numbers, which previously had to be extrapolated, but after calls by the public and press to post local data, the Arkansas Center for Healthcare Improvement stepped up. Dr. Joe Thompson is the center's CEO.
Weekly, I've been talking to members of the Municipal League, and they clamor for local numbers at their city level. So in partnership with the health department, we analyzed the health department's data, found a way to actually release at the city level information about each city that had more than 10 total cases.
To protect patient anonymity, that was July 20th. The data regards community cases only, excluding correctional facilities.
Correct. We did not include correctional facilities. We took the street address that the positive patients, when the health department called them, the individuals gave as their street address, and then we assigned to cities both using the city name and the zip code.
Arkansans can find sliding bar alphabetical lists of hundreds of Arkansas cities revealing cumulative COVID-19 cases since March 11th. The tables are updated weekly on Thursday. Initially, the website crashed due to a surge of interest.
We had a little more demand than we anticipated on that first day. We had over 16,000 hits to our website, and candidly, we weren't prepared for that level of interest. We've beefed it up, and I think we'll be able to support a much larger level of interest and much more use going forward. And the website is safe. I think the fact that it crashed, people may have gotten a warning sign, but we're up, our certificates are in place, and we're ready to provide information at the local level.
Late last week at the governor's press conference, the Arkansas Center for Health Improvement announced it's now listing communities with actively infected individuals.
Those individuals that are actively infected and the number in communities across the state. Sorted anyway, alphabetically, if you want to find your city easily or by rank order for numbers. Obviously, the most populated cities are going to have the most numbers, most likely. Little Rock is number one, followed by Springdale, and then it steps on down. I think it's important to note, though, that many of our smaller cities have over 10 individuals that are actively infected. So this is now a statewide issue affecting every community across the state.
Also on July 15th, the center rolled out a COVID local risk index to help identify cities and neighborhoods with populations at higher risk of catching the virus.
Yes, we put out for the five cities, largest cities in Arkansas, including those in the Fayetteville Springdale area, a risk profile of the community themselves. This virus is attacking or having a worse impact on lower income communities and communities of color. And obviously, those are not evenly distributed across our larger cities. So we put out this risk index to let folks know where extra effort should be taken to raise awareness, to offer protection, and for resources to be placed to help those that will be most affected.
The rationale for publishing this additional data is to instill in Arkansans, Thompson says, that the entire state is at risk during this pandemic.
I think the more local information we can have, the more local individuals will recognize that it is a threat and they'll take the steps necessary to help us stop the spread of this virus.
Dr. Joe Thompson says this key information enables lawmakers and leaders to decide how to better protect the public.
Our center is proud to be able to partner with the health department and offer them some surge capacity during this, critical pandemic. What I hope we're able to do is provide local leaders, both elected leaders, business leaders, faith-based leaders, tangible information that they can bring to their constituents so that together we can mount a response to stop the spread of this virus. It's hand washing, it's social distancing, it's using a facial covering. Those are our major tools right now, and we need all hands on deck.
Arkansas Center for Health Improvement data can be found at ACHI.net on the COVID-19 page. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Pencils, check. Notebook paper, check. What about a mask? With schools across the state set to begin some form of in-class instruction on August 24th, back-to-school shopping has been unlike any previous year. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth explains.
In most households across the U.S., back-to-school shopping is an event.
You're going to go, you're going to have breakfast, and we're going to go back-to-school shopping, and everybody has their list, and it's kind of this fun getting the new pencils, getting the new pens, right?
For Sarah Heimer and her three kids, this summer shopping was a little less eventful.
This year just has kind of an eerie feeling of difference. it's taking a kid and going, okay, we have 10 minutes and you're going to get all these things, right? Instead of it being an hour and a half ordeal, which is normally what we would do, where we look and wander the aisles, we touch all the things, right? We pick up the pin packet because we might like these colors, and then we set it down, and then we pick up this other pin packet. And so we've adopted to doing more of it online and limited, right, the in-store stuff.
Two of Heimer's kids go to Fayetteville Public Schools, and one is at Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville. All three have opted for a hybrid option, virtual and in-person. She says the schools did provide a list of normal essential items, but it also included some previously unusual materials.
One of the most interesting things was composition notebooks. I have an elementary school student, and normally there's notebook paper, right? You have to get three reams of this and three composition notebooks. And those were actually missing from the list. I think my elementary school student had one composition notebook, and usually it's drastically different. And I think for me as a parent in that moment, it's kind of this data point of going, oh, literally everything's virtual on the computer. Like, they're trying to limit kids touching things. You know, extra things that we added this year, we bought extra water bottles because fountains won't be on at school. And also the mask thing, you know, it's a weird thing when you're like, kids, okay, let's go mask shopping online. What kind of design do you want on yours? And it's an odd conversation to have.
Because school shopping is drastically different in 2020, stores are trying to pivot to meet customers' needs. Walmart, the biggest U.S. retailer, is funneling more shoppers to online resources and betting big on personal electronics. Spokesperson Casey Staley.
We've also been looking a lot at virtual learning. You know, that might be a very big impact this year. It may be a reality for a lot of families. So we're partnering with top brands like ABC Mouse, PBS Kids, Disney, Crayola, Sullivan Learning, to offer workbooks and online content to help kids continue their education at home. Parents can also find workbooks in stores nationwide. And again, that's with Walmart's everyday low prices. Additionally, we've also got walmart.com/learning, and it'll feature video content and learning resources from our partners, and additional workbooks and learning products, as well as bonus experiences for, you know, easy lessons and activities for the kids.
Staley also says the company is adding masks, cleaning items, and hand sanitizers to their usual back-to-school section. The accounting firm Deloitte estimates that in 2020, back-to-school spending will reach more than $28 billion, which is on par with 2019 spending, but the company does project a drop in traditional materials like notebooks and stationery, and a rise in electronics. Heimer says she actually spent about $100 more than usual on supplies this year.
I think for us with the hybrid learning model, I actually bought more multiples of stuff. So they have a set for school and a set for home, which added a little bit more to the expense line. But there's so much ambiguity at the moment that I want my kids to feel like they're prepared for the situations they're walking into, whether that's at home or that's in the physical school building. And so we're doing kind of extra things.
And parents aren't the only ones stocking up before students return this month. Cody Vest, an English teacher at Rogers Heritage High School, says while his school usually covers most of his classroom expenses, he'll often budget for books or cleaning supplies. This year, it's masks.
We are being provided with some PPE. I have spent money on just stuff for myself. I bought several masks. You know, I'm sure there's more things I'm going to think of as it gets closer, but masks are been my biggest expense.
He says Rogers Heritage is also trying to limit sharing items between teachers and students.
You know, if a kid needs a pencil, I'm always just, you know, here, if there's a pile over here, grab one. We're not allowed to do that. So we had to come up with, as a department, a list of a supplies students needed to bring and have prepared for each individual department.
Kristen Pankey, a first grade teacher at Jones Elementary in Springdale, says she focuses on collaboration in her classroom.
We do a lot of partner work, a lot of group work, little plastic objects that they use to practice counting or other number skills, or it's literally anything under the sun. Like sometimes it's things in the dollar bin at Target, and then sometimes it's bigger, more like education-minded things like a base 10 block.
Now she's looking for durable and washable items for individual use, and she says the money for those items comes from a $500 budget.
The $500 is specifically for instructional use, but once that $500 is gone and it goes faster than you might think, then it comes out of my own pocket.
She says PPE is not included in that.
They are providing us a $20 allowance for PPE. And then, like, I've used my own money, because that's not an instructional-specific thing, I've used my own money to get fabric to make masks for my students. They're also issuing, in Springdale, all students will get 2 masks issued to them. So I work at a school that has a lot of families in need and a lot of families who experience poverty at a very significant level. And so I want my kids to have an extra mask, and if I can, it'll be more than that. It just will depend, honestly, on how much time I have to sew them.
Walmart spokesperson Casey Staley says the company is using online resources to make back-to-school shopping a little easier for students and teachers.
Especially for teachers, we've set up a designated teacher section in our stores and online at walmart.com/teachers. We've also got, for teachers, our events registry, where they can go in there and create a classroom wish list to easily share their needs with others.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
This week, the Fayetteville School District revised its reopening plan. Originally, FPS was going to offer a hybrid model that provided in-person instruction to students 2 days a week, virtual learning the other 3. The decision to change came on Wednesday, just hours after the Arkansas Secretary of Education, Johnny Key, issued guidance that requires all school districts to offer on-site learning opportunities 5 days a week. Teachers and parents alike say they're frustrated. Anna Bolia, a high school French teacher and president of the Fayetteville Education Association.
The decision or mandate by the governor and Secretary Key is making us go backwards towards a more unsafe option.
Ann Morrow is a mother of 5 girls, all of whom attended Fayetteville schools until this past Tuesday, when they officially transferred to the Elkins School District, which has a plan of offering 5 days of in-person instruction.
We've had a really hard time anyway. And then with school approaching, I was thinking, finally, you know, I'm going to be able to work every day and we're going to be okay. And I'm going to work 2 jobs if I have to, and we're just going to make it. You know, we're just going to do it somehow.
Morrow says Fayetteville's original plan would make that nearly impossible, which is why she made the difficult decision to pull her daughters from the district. And now that Fayetteville will be offering 5 days of in-person instruction, she doesn't know what she'll do. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek will have a lot more from her conversation with Morrow and Bolia on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large at noon and 7. This is Ozarks at Large. This week, the United States Census Bureau announced it would end field data collection September 30th, a month earlier than planned. The end of September is now the deadline for people to complete the census online, over the phone, or by mail. To find out how the decision impacts Arkansans, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reached out to Brad Cameron, communications chairman for Arkansas Counts, a statewide initiative to get a complete count of the state for the 2020 census. Cameron says he was very surprised by the change.
As of late last week, we heard an NPR report from Hansi Lu Wong that the census was quietly suggesting that it would suspend field operations effective September 30th. We were waiting to hear back on what that would mean for the acceptance of responses online and via phone. And then earlier this week found out that all operations would be suspended effective September 30th, a full month earlier than previously announced.
And so how does that impact the plans of the committee? Did you have other initiatives to roll out to get more people to respond? How does this impact your group?
It really put everything into hyperdrive. We were excited to have that additional month to really engage communities in a socially distanced way. You know, as you can imagine, we've had to adjust our outreach strategies every step of the way. You know, we started the year off really excited to go to festivals, do door-to-door canvassing, engage residents at libraries, and then all of that shut down in March. So we adjusted strategy to really focus on engaging local media, engaging faith leaders, getting essential businesses involved. And so, you know, we've had to be nimble every step of the way this year. In addition, you know, because the census was moved online for the first time in our nation's history, the Bureau really prioritized online engagement and media engagement, as opposed to in the past that really relied on door-to-door knocking. So that's been cut back, which really adversely affects a rural state like Arkansas, where we're, you know, in the bottom five for internet access. There are large pockets that lack even cellular signal. And so we've had to lean heavily on our partners. So initially we were planning on having our partners engage folks in community, and then we had to have them get the word out with every resource available. And so along the way, yeah, we've had to engage the faith community. We've had to engage local businesses. We're getting ready to distribute materials for back to school that have been developed by Arkansas advocates. But yeah, we've really had to adjust our strategy over and over again this year as new surprises have come up along the way.
So you mentioned passing out some information with back to school things. Any other specific initiatives that you'll be doing in the next, I guess, 2 months to get the word out? Any more physical pieces of paper that you'll hang on a door, or kind of can take me through what the plan is now?
Absolutely. So in overnight, we took our 90-day strategy and truncated it down to a 60-day strategy. And so what we've seen to be effective is, as we started just last week in partnership with Arkansas United, phone and text banking, using the resources Outvote and ThruTalk. And so we have online training for how to access those resources, Outvote and ThruTalk, and how, what the script is for calling and texting people to encourage them to complete the count. I'm on calls with local city halls and small local papers, encouraging them to share stories about the new census deadline. And then we're also going to be putting up billboards in the 20 counties with the lowest response rate to, again, just trying everything we can to encourage folks to complete the census at my2020census.gov or by calling the phone number 844-330-2020. And then after folks complete the census, the next best step is have them encourage them to tell 20 other folks to complete the census as well.
Speaking of the response rate, the state as a whole, its response rate is around 57% right now. In 2010, it was 62%, so not too terribly far off, but still not close to 100%, which is the effort of groups like yours is getting a complete count. What are some of the issues that you run into, even in a non-pandemic year, of people not completing the census? Why do they not answer the questions or turn in the responses?
Well, let me go up to why the census matters in the first place. A 1% undercount of our state costs us about $1 billion over the next decade. So where we stand right now, we have had less than 4 in 10 households respond to the census. As you said, we're right almost at 57% for Arkansas, but that's going to be about a $60 billion loss to our state for roads, healthcare, to respond to crises like our current pandemic, the resources that we rely on to provide exceptional education to Arkansas students. And so right now we stand to lose about $60 billion for, again, education, healthcare, infrastructure like roads. And the people that are most undercounted now are the ones who have historically been undercounted. And these are children under 5, people of color, rural residents, low-income people, and people currently experiencing homelessness. And so now, just as in the past, we were really relying on that additional time for door knocking activities to ensure that those hard to count people are represented in the census. And ironically, these are the people that most rely on the resources that the census makes available. And so it's really important for us to, again, get out the count.
What are some of the reasons that you've heard from people about why they don't respond?
So especially among immigrant communities, there has been great fear. The Supreme Court a year ago, last June of 2019, ruled that we could not include a citizenship question, that immigrant communities felt were targeting them for reasons that would sacrifice their safety. That has also recently come up with an executive order issued last week. So within the immigrant community, there is enormous mistrust toward the government as a result of what has been said at the federal level. Rural communities, it's, again, there is really just lack of infrastructure for responding to the census. I was talking to Mara Larson of Jasper just this morning, and she explained to me that many of the folks in her community have PO boxes. They don't have mailboxes. And so when the census sent out the forms to complete, many folks may have not received them, or have simply just not checked their mailboxes in a while. But I think just most broadly, because of the prioritization of completing the census online and our state just being one of the lowest for internet access, that has had a dramatic negative impact on our response rate.
You mentioned the distrust, but isn't there some kind of rule or law that that information can't be just handed over to anybody?
Absolutely. So it is a federal crime for the Bureau to provide personally identifying information on any individual resident. And that information is kept confidential for a minimum of 72 years. And there is a hefty fine and potentially prison time for anybody that breaks that confidentiality. And so, according to federal law, the Bureau is unable to provide personally identifying information, and census responses do not cannot be shared with ICE or law enforcement, or result in any penalties for in receiving federal benefits.
If people have more questions about that, or maybe just want a little bit more reassurance, or even just help filling out the census, who should they contact?
You know, we're really relying on our Arkansas Counts partners, especially Arkansas United and the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, to provide that support to folks in completing the census, to answer any questions they have. And so for English and Spanish questions, we're encouraging folks to contact Arkansas United by phone at 479-347-2824. And for our Marshallese communities, we're working closely with the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese. And so if Marshallese individuals have questions about the census or need help filling it out, we're having them call the Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese at 479-365-6625. So we're consistently telling folks to just get counted. They can get counted at my2020census.gov or by calling 844-330-2020. And after folks complete the census, they need to tell 20 other people to do the same. Because as of today, we only have 56 days to get Arkansas counted.
Brad Cameron is Communications Chairman for Arkansas Counts. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda earlier this week. More information available at arcounts.org.
That's Alice Coltrane in the background playing piano, and I'm Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday here on KUAF. We'll hear more from Alice Coltrane, as well as her son Ravi and her husband John Coltrane, Chet Baker, George Benson, Cannonball Adderley, much, much more. Shades of Jazz, right here on KUAF 91.3 FM.
This is Ozarks Lodge with me on the phone, I think from her home in Bella Vista. Is that where you are, Becca?
I am.
All right. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
So you may think you don't have plans this weekend.
But?
But you're wrong.
Okay. Tell me. What are my plans?
This sounds like a typical weekend conversation we're about to have. So tonight is the new play festival installment. It is not happening at Theater Squared. It is happening online.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it'll be a Zoom sort of performance. But I watched the last one, and I forgot that I was watching something on Zoom.
Well, that's a high compliment, Becca.
So I think it'll be fabulous, and I'm really interested in the play. It's called The Interrogator, and the playwright, Russell Lee Sherman, says he can't believe that nobody has written about this. It's a story that's set at Fort Hunt, which was a prisoner of war camp in Alexandria, Virginia. It was used as an interrogation center during the war and immediately after the war, where they had thousands of Nazi officers and U-boat commanders pass through. And the interrogators, the only ones they could find who knew the language and the culture well enough, were recent immigrants to the United States, most of them German and Austrian Jews.
This sounds incredibly fascinating.
Tonight at 7 o'clock, it will be streaming at playarkansas.com. You can be admitted by donation. And tonight's reading will be followed by a conversation with the creative team. And then there's encore streaming available through Monday. Then on Saturday morning, you can virtually go to the Museum of Native American History in Bentonville for two story time events. Gail Ross, who has been involved with the museum and is a storyteller from Tahlequah, is going to tell a kid's story about the Cherokee trickster rabbit. She says sometimes rabbit ends up being goofy and just hurting himself, and other times his tricks work out pretty well. But these are stories intended for young people. And then the second story is called The Daughter of the Sun, and it's intended more for adults. It's a story of how the Native people almost lost their relationship with the sun and the toll that took on them. Stories were recorded in one take at the Museum of Native American History, and they're the first of a new series that the museum is going to do called Hear Our Voices. What you do is go and register at mona.us, M-O-N-A-H.us, and they'll email you a link to the event webpage. It's free. It's available beginning at 11 a.m. Saturday. Saturday evening. Theater Squared is trying to do some other things too, and they're going to stream a live performance on Saturday with Grammy winner Larry Mitchell, U.S. Poet Laureate Joy Harjo, and blues and folk musician Katie Martin. And they're actually doing it for a small audience in the West Theater, appropriately socially distanced, wearing masks, all of that. But it's also a test drive for their new multi-camera high-def broadcast system, which is how we can see theater this fall. So you could go to theater2.org and find out how to get in on the live stream or call 777-7477. And then if we warn you out and you need to relax on Sunday,
right,
there's new music from Sycamore, which is a brand new band that Guy Ames and several of his friends just started. But they have a new, they call it a CD. It's kind of more of an EP. It's five songs. But it's kind of anthems for right now. The title of it is A Place to Make a Stand.
Right.
One of the songs is called When the Age of Oil Comes Undone. The music is available streaming on most popular places that you would find streaming music.
Right.
But if you, like many of us, want the CD, which has lovely cover art by Denise Nicholson, you can send a check for $12 to Guy Ames, 18292 Wildlife Road in Fayetteville, 72701.
Excellent.
And you can come back Sunday for What's Up, because we have stories about a new Shiloh Museum exhibit titled Queen for a Day. We also have stories about where you can, a story about where you can catch drag queens performing online. I liked the juxtaposition of that. And Jocelyn Murphy's look at some of the films for this year's Bentonville Film Festival, which really is happening online and in person starting the 10th.
There you go. So there's some things to do.
Isn't that cool? We just had an entire weekend.
Yeah, like you said.
I feel some hope.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the masks, the distance, the clean hands, keep doing it, right?
Wash your hands, wear your mask, and if you don't feel comfortable going out, there's NBA basketball, so you know where I'll be.
Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. We'll talk again next Friday, Becca.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
What makes a vacation memorable? For some people, it's the food and the drinks.
There's this bar in the Canadian Arctic you can go to, and you do a shot while having pressed up against your lips the toe of a dead man.
How strange situations leave us with happy memories. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Hidden Brain, tomorrow afternoon at 3, and then again Sunday morning at 6 on 91.3 KUAF. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and West Fork. 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Contributors to this Friday evening edition of our show included Jacqueline Froelich, Daniel Carruth, Antoinette Grajeda, and Zuzana Sitek. We will have more from Zuzana's conversations with parents about choosing a school district on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large. That's Monday at noon and 7. Timothy Dennis mastered our show tonight. And, of course, we appreciate our Friday collaborators, Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics and Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. We will be back with you Sunday morning at 9 for the next edition of Weekend Ozarks at Large, and then back Monday to start a brand new week of daily shows of Ozarks at Large every Monday through Friday at noon and 7. Next week, the story of a professor at Arkansas Little Rock who in the 1970s was essentially fired because he said he was a communist, plus monarch butterflies, mystery seeds mailed to Arkansans, and, as I mentioned before, Zuzana's story on Monday about tough choices facing parents as the school year approaches. And each day, we'll have the latest news on COVID-19 and Arkansas and our region. That's all coming up next week. You can find out more about us at KUAF.com. You can subscribe to our free podcast through all major podcast contributors. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Carver Center for Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Be safe. Talk to you soon.